Welcome to the State of Business with the Ohio Society of CPAs. This is the show for CPAs, where we discuss the latest developments in technology, business management, career planning, and much more that are impacting the way you advance the state of business. I'm Jessica Salerno, Senior Content Manager, and in this episode, I'm speaking with Mike Moran, President and Co-Founder of Affiliated Resource Group, an IT implementation and professional services firm. Mike will be speaking on cyber fraud at our upcoming Akron CPE Day on September 18th and Dayton CPE Day on November 16th. And with more than 20 years of business technology consulting experience, he has seen his fair share of fraud attacks. We talked about what businesses are being targeted, how companies can protect themselves, and what the future looks like for cybercrime. How would you define cybercrime, cyber fraud for people who think that they know what it is but might not really know?
Well, if you really think about it, the idea of a cybercrime has many facets. It could be someone stealing your credentials. It could be, and we read about that all the time. For example, you know, probably the biggest, most well-known one was the one that happened to Equifax, which was the report, the financial reporting services, where they went in and stole all of these people's credentials in terms of where it is. It could be something along the lines of what happened at Home Depot, where again, they broke in and stole people's credentials. It could be a ransomware attack where you are being required to pay money for something. It could be a spoofing situation where they pretended to be you and they sent an email to or a phone call to someone and asked for money or they asked for information from that. So from a cyber fraud perspective, a cyber crime, as a non-legal official, if you will, I think that they are fairly synonymous because they are actually taking things from someone that they have no right to do. Is that a reasonable perspective?
Yeah, it is. And something that in your description made me think of this. So it's not necessarily one type of thing that happens to one type of individual. Like it sounds like it can be a lot of different acts, if you will, and then an individual, corporation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's from a personal perspective, your information can be taken in a variety of different ways. From a corporate perspective, their intellectual property could be stolen or information about their employees or their customers. You know, from a healthcare perspective, you have people that are accessing people's personal health records. And that is a type of cyber fraud because they may choose to do that in a different manner. People say, well, why would that happen? Well, there's a case that occurred. I'm trying to remember the exact state, but basically a group of patient records were taken and they ended up being used by an insurance agent who was soliciting them for Medicare Part D and variety of coverages. So it's something that you look at and say, I'm taking information that is not mine, and I'm trying to use it to my own benefit in terms of where that goes.
Right. So who are the type of people committing these crimes?
Well, it's kind of funny. There's a variety of folks today. You know, we typically kind of think of the idea of just a hacker who might be, you know, in their apartment or in their parents' basement, but right. It's really become big business. You know, the actual payouts for ransomware crossed the $1 billion range. So people paid $1 billion in that they've defined in terms of ransom for getting their files back when they were taken care of. But when you really look at it, is who doesn't report what they had? A whole lot of people, because they're not required to. So it's a big, big multi-billion dollar business. And when you figure in all the costs that's there, but you have government agencies. We see it all the time on the TV. The Russians are involved in this. We know the Chinese, the Iranians, the North Koreans, they all have cyber hacking units, organized crime themselves. I mean, they realized that years ago, if I wanted to get money, I had to go rob a bank. Well, if I had to rob a bank, I had to physically go there. And there was a risk that I was going to get, you know, caught. Somebody might have shot me. And this, I'm sitting in an office building or I'm sitting in an apartment. The odds of me getting shot or having to get my hands dirty, so to speak, are much smaller. Most everyone who has an email account has received an email from, the assistant prime minister from some small African nation who is looking to do that. There are huge organized crime groups in Nigeria that are very strong on this. It's really a worldwide phenomenon. There's the standard white collar and opportunistic people here in the United States as well. So it's really a broad-based scenario, but people have realized that they can make money from this. And it's easy to target smaller organizations. I mean, everybody thinks, I'm a small company, why does it matter? Well, many of these folks are using programs that are actually just searching for random IP addresses. And they know which random IP addresses are assigned to the United States. The United States is a wealthy country. So I'm just going to have my program go after these IP addresses until I can potentially find a vulnerability. I can send out 10, 20, 30,000 emails a month to people in big packets. And maybe one or two of them will respond. And maybe I can get a couple $1,000s out of that. Well, hey, if I can make $5, $10, $20,000 a month from just sending out simple emails and absconding from the fact that people are either gullible or not paying attention, $10, $20,000 a month isn't a bad living.
No, certainly not.
And of course, I'm not paying taxes on that, so it's even better. But that's an example of where that plays.
Right. And I know in the beginning when you were describing cyber crime and cyber fraud, you mentioned a lot of different ways that it can happen. Can you go more into what those
Sure.
would be?
You know, we typically think about that idea of in a fraud scenario, you have the capability of send somebody an email. You have the ability to send them what's called a phishing email. And, you know, MTV has that catfishing show where people decide they're somebody else and they go at it. There's a lot of that that goes on. I mean, the idea of that email that you get from the assistant prime minister of a small African country or someone in some foreign country who's just gotten a ton of money and they're trying to get it out. Those are simple emails that are that way. But people also do a spear phishing email where they will actually spoof someone that may be a customer of yours, that may be a vendor to you. And it may look like today we're even seeing a lot more of executive spoofing where they're spoofing the email of a leader of a larger organization sending an email. So for example, it might be Mike Moran at mycompany.com, and Mike's the CEO of our company, but he always goes by Michael. But they might send a Mike Moran and they might say, I need you to send this information to this email address, or I need you to wire some money to one of our vendors to start a special project. And none of it is real. And sometimes folks in accounts payable or in payroll or different areas, they may click on that and they've now gotten caught. We're also seeing a certain amount of, and this is kind of an old school thing, but it's starting to pick up, where people do what they call phishing, which is a V, where they actually will call and ask for information. Probably the most simplest is that, hi, this is Mike in IT, Jessica. I am working on your systems and a couple of your applications. I need your ID and password.
So would that be more for like large companies?
It works across the board. When we do our risk analysis and we do our user awareness training, it's amazing the number of times that people at companies with under 100 employees will have someone who's just trying to be helpful or someone who's just trying to address the issue and get through their day, and they'll either click on the email or they'll provide the information because, hey, you know what? I have had a problem or two with my computer. Boom, here's my credentials. And once someone has those credentials, they now have a certain level of access to your system.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I know you mentioned that this is something that happens to small companies as well. I'm curious, are there any that are specifically being targeted more than others?
I think a lot of it is just random. If you think about it, smaller organizations that have and sometimes these folks don't know. I'll give you an example. A hacker went in and did some information to a large global a $5 billion company. And he was able to use a ransomware scenario that locked down some files in this organization. And he asked for $5,000 ransom to free up the files. It's a $5 billion company. He probably could have gotten a whole lot more. Whereas he didn't know the difference between that company and if it would have been, a very small organization with 20 employees, where $5,000 is a pretty significant outlay for them, where to a global company, that it's money, but it's nowhere near that. So they really aren't necessarily looking at a specific scenario. They're looking for someone who has lesser security, someone who may not have that level of awareness of the issue. They're looking, and a lot of smaller organizations don't have that because they think that they've lulled themselves into a, I'm safe because of the fact that I'm a small company and, you know, I'm out in the middle of nowhere, so to speak, and who's really going to know what's going on? And it's still, everyone needs to have that awareness and that vigilance to help look out for it, because with a smaller company, a $5,000, you know, hit is a significant hit in terms of where that goes. It's not to say that it's not important to a larger company, but $5,000 to them is a whole lot different than $5,000 to a company that has $1 million or less in revenues in the course of a year, or to a nonprofit organization that has, you know, that has got to count on every dollar they have because they get their funding from grants or from donations.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And especially in the context of what you were saying earlier about it being random. Like, they're not specifically targeting these big companies because they know how much money they have. They're just looking for anything.
Right. And a lot of it, again, as I said, a lot of it is done through automated activity. Now, there is spear phishing where someone has decided that I'm interested in someone's intellectual property or I'm into that, where they really kind of tailor their message, they tailor their focus to actually someone that has things. I mean, I would imagine a lot of people, as they look at that, and we have tools that help prevent it, but I still have a separate account where I kind of get a generic group of things that come in. And I mean, I receive information on a weekly basis that are banks and things that I don't deal with, but I have seen a number of times where I've gotten stuff from American Express, and you know, I do have an American Express account, so all of a sudden that's a little more personal to me. Now, whether it's specifically targeted because of that, or if it's just kind of a random, well, gee, there's a whole lot of people that have American Express cards, I can't answer that. But you pay attention if you get an email from American Express. But if you don't have an account at Bank America, well, it's either they're trying to get you, or if they tell you that in the title your account has been frozen from Bank America, well, you know, that's just someone doing a phishing exercise to try and get you to click on something. But it is still amazing how many people do that.
Right. Yeah. And like what you were going back to saying within the companies, how they're doing it sort of in an effort to be helpful, to taking advantage of people's good nature.
Yeah. After, you know, I've spent probably the last 18 months really, really involved in this and looking at all of the different approaches. And it is amazing that, you know, you used to get frustrated when you would call your phone provider, you might call the bank and, you know, I can't remember my stuff. Can't you just help me? And they would say no, and you get mad at them and they're like, some customer service. Well, ever since I've started seeing this and how these folks use these the kindness of the people that are there, I strongly support folks being able to say, I'm following procedure, and procedure said, if you can't give me this information, I'm not going to help you because I can't. Right. And I think that's just protecting me as a consumer. And I think that's very good. And you see the same thing at healthcare, where if you're dealing with a family member, a related family member, or a friend, they really aren't allowed to provide you information about that person's health. And I respect that. I think that's really important to recognize that they're not trying to do it in a malicious way. They're just trying to protect it's the law and we're following it. We're looking out for the patient.
Right. And speaking of protection, do you think companies, individuals are doing enough to protect themselves against cyber fraud?
I think that there's a lot of folks that believe, you know, I have a spam filter, I have a firewall, I look at that. I really think that the whole concept of user awareness training is so much more important to help people really see the risks and the threats that are out there and help them get prepared to do that. I think that's important. I really think that companies should assess where they are in the spectrum. They need to have an honest conversation about what are we trying to protect and are we prepared to do that? You know, if you think about how technology has advanced over the last 5 years, I mean, you're talking to me today from a Surface, a workstation in that regard. Many, many, many more organizations have opened up Wi-Fi. They've opened up bringing your own device to work. And yet, the security scenarios that they have to protect the organization were implemented well before those technologies became available. I was making a presentation a couple weeks ago to a group of school districts and talking to them about some of their compliance responsibilities. And I got a call 2 days later from one of the folks that was there. They had been hit with a ransomware attack, and the folks were able to get in because they were able to access their system through their HVAC provider's access. They had had an HVAC provider was there to help bring down the costs of maintaining the heating and cooling in their buildings. And so they had automated controls and those things, and they had to have a connection. Well, the providers of the ransomware were able to get in through that access point. And I think that that's an example of the fact that in many cases, people don't look at how is our network set up? Are we segmented in terms of where that goes? I mean, one of the reasons why, and this was, you know, if you think about it, this was 3-4 years ago, one of the reasons why the Home Depot breach was so broad was because they had what's called a flat network, where very few people are aware that at the same point in time, Lowe's actually had a breach as well. However, Lowe's network was segmented, so their risk was somewhat limited as opposed to what happened with Home Depot. Yet both of them were breached not through their own systems, but through third-party providers that had access to their systems. So those are all things that, to me, organizations of all sizes really need to kind of take that step and look at the assessment from a leadership perspective. What are we trying to protect? When was the last time we did a review of our systems? How are we doing it? And it's easy to say, well, I've got a good IT person or I've got a good third-party company helping me. But I'm talking to the Ohio Society of CPAs. Most folks do a review of their books every year. Why aren't you considering doing a review of your security? You change your business. You adjust your website. You may provide access to additional people. You have turnover in your business. All of those things provide options for those that are looking to do malicious activities to get into your system. It's helping to kind of do that annual checkup and annual cleanup to help prevent that.
Yeah, absolutely. So how do you think that CPAs and accounting professionals specifically can help with their business?
Sure. I think that when you look at folks that are in that financial responsibility area, some of this is policy and procedure. Some of this is it's things that have been there all along, but it's just refreshing that scenario. Like, for example, when you look at that, you know, do we have a password policy that's reasonable? Is it a password policy that requires a complex password? Does it require that we change it every reasonable amount of time? And that's not a 12 or 24 or 36 months, but, you know, is it changed every 90 days? Are we allowed to use the same password over and over again, or do we have to change it? Why does that matter? Well, because you start to see if your information was compromised and it's out on the dark web, well, I might have your company email and your ID. If I don't force you to change that password, you could have the same one a year or two later and somebody could come in and get it. The other thing is that it's a reminder of policies and procedures. We don't do a wire transfer without a phone or a written confirmation. We don't do certain things from the business end to say, we're just going to randomly send out a spreadsheet with all of our payroll. So it is, these are not necessarily technology policies and procedures, but those are that. The financial people and the CPAs, the CFOs, if you will, that have responsibility over the IT department, ask some of the questions of what are our policies and procedures? Where are our validation that we're doing our patching, we're doing our antivirus activity? What are we looking at to ensure that our backups are correct? Yeah, some of these things are going to cost the organization additional funding, but Lord knows, if you have an attack, if you become a victim of a ransomware attack, the better your backup systems are, the more complete they are, the faster you're going to recover and the less productivity you're going to lose. I mean, we had a customer a while back who had, unfortunately, they did get hit with ransomware. And it does happen. The best protection in the world isn't going to guarantee you won't get hit, but it does happen. And we were able to restore all of their servers and all of their information without them having to pay anything for the ransom, if you will. We were able to get all of that done, and they basically lost 15 minutes of processing because their backups were clean. So that's an important thing to look at in terms of what are we doing. It really is something that folks have to look at on a regular basis. It's not I can do it once and set it and forget it. I really have to be vigilant because your business changes every day, every week, every month. And those are all things that need to be done. And you know, IT folks are pretty busy. They have a lot of responsibilities themselves, from day-to-day user support to application support to try and set up the infrastructure to manage the operations and how things work in an organization. And sometimes they can't do it all. And sometimes the organization started off and we had 20, 30 employees and we hired a person and it was great, or we hired a firm to do it. But man, we've been able to grow because of organic growth or because we've done acquisitions. And now I've got 100 or 150 employees. And golly, I still have that same person. And it may have outgrown their capabilities. Or, you know, gee, the idea of no one ever thought we needed to have complex network to connect 7 or 8 offices, and we had people that telecommute like you do here at the Society. Well, there's other requirements that you have to deal with there. And it's, how do I take care of all of those things? And maybe you had a third-party provider helping you out, but maybe it's just a small company and they haven't had that experience. So that really is a good step to look at on an annual basis. How are we with IT? In our customer's case, we help them with a strategy. We put together we call it a 6Q, where we've laid out kind of their IT needs for the next 6 quarters. Why? So that they're in a rolling scenario of evaluating how business, their needs, and where things are. And part of it's to reduce the surprises, but it's also there to start looking at, well, we want to keep your IT aligned to your business goals. And that's a key part of what we're doing there.
Absolutely. And I know that you listed earlier a lot of great ways that accountants and CPAs can kind of get ahead of the curve. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, what is one really common mistake that you've seen companies make when it comes to protecting themselves against cyber fraud?
Well, it sounds kind of funny, but so many people today use their cell phones to conduct all of their business. And if you think about it, when you look at your cell phone and you're trying to deal with your email, you really don't get a full picture because it's all an abbreviated piece on your screen. It says that it's from Mike Moran, but is it really? And I'll give you one quick example, and I think this kind of hits home. I travel a fair amount, and I happen to get an email from apparently American Express that I had a problem with my account. And I'm sitting on my phone and I click the button and there's this official looking email from American Express that said, you've got a problem, click here to start. Well, again, I'm kind of an old school guy and I tend to just use the 800 number because it's easier. And so I said, well, wait a minute, instead of doing anything, let me go back to the hotel and I'll get this taken care of. Well, later I went back to the hotel, I opened up my laptop, I opened up my email and my Outlook scenario, and I've got it set up so that you have a fairly broad preview window. And we've learned that you start at the top and you look at who the email's from and you come down. Well, the email wasn't from American Express, even though it said that. It was from a guy named Dave at CaptureX.com. And there was no phone number on that scenario for me to call, which there is in the normal scenario. So if I would have clicked that email, I might have given him my credentials, which would have given him access to my American Express account. But on my phone, I couldn't see that.
Right.
So it's understanding how, and again, that's part of that user awareness training, but it's understanding how you set your policies and procedures to do that. I don't send stuff via my cell phone. I use it as a way to see things. I may be unique in that, but that's something that folks really need to start thinking about is, how do I use it for my advantage? But at the same point in time, is it providing me with a disadvantage? Right. And I think that's one of the things that it's a basic concept, but it's a concept that matters.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I've never heard that with the cell phone, but it does make sense.
Yeah, and it's a great tool. There's no question about it.
Right.
However, it's just everything has its ups and its downs and its limitations.
Absolutely. So how do you predict cybercrime will evolve in the future? I know we've talked a lot about there's
sure.
things that you can do today, but 5 to 10 years down the road.
I think it's going to continue to be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to continue to be, as long as folks can make money from it, they're going to be in a position where they're going to continue to look to exploit people, and it's fairly easy. So I think that the more that folks have awareness, and yes, the industry is coming up with more and more tools to help protect and limit some of that. And compared to where it used to be, we're much better, you know, spam filters and some of that. At the same point in time, as the tools to protect evolve, the tools to exploit are going to evolve.
Right.
So it is that proverbial cat and mouse game where you just have to have that level of vigilance. And I think that a common sense approach to how you as a financial resource with fiduciary responsibility look at this and say, we may have to allocate more investments, more expenses to these things. We may have to look at this as a bigger part because, again, if you think about it in the grocery business, they look at 1-3% slippage in the retail business, that idea of shoplifting and what that is. Well, when you're Walmart, that's a huge number. So the question then becomes, how do we start to address that in normal organizations from a cyber scenario to try and help prevent that? Because again, for some companies, a $5,000 hit once a year isn't that big a deal. But if I'm a small organization, that could be a lot bigger. And what a lot of companies don't look at is, well, just paying $5,000 ransom is nothing. I had to pay IT people, maybe overtime or a third party company to come in and help do things. I may have had other issues that I had that were costs in terms of maybe I couldn't get orders out the door. If I'm a law firm, one of the challenges is that the government, you know, when you have motions and you have different things that you're doing from a court perspective, you're expected to provide those responses or those activities by a certain time. And if you don't do it, you have major issues. Well, if I can't submit an information that's mandated by the court by a certain time because my systems are down, I could have huge liability to my client because they have a right now to sue me for something. Mm-hmm. And those are things that, again, it's how are we looking at our systems and how are we looking to put the tools and things in place that will allow us to accomplish our goals within a reasonable impact and likelihood, if you will, matrix to understand where that business goes. Does
right.
that help?
It does.
Okay.
It does. For someone listening who doesn't have a lot of experience in this area, but they know they want to get involved, they want to help, what is one piece of advice that you would offer them from a CPA accounting perspective?
Sure. I think it's understanding that issue of what are we trying to protect? What have we done? Does it seem like it's enough? And if not, ask questions. Have a conversation with your IT person or your IT provider. Ask them what they think about some of these things. They may have a whole lot of answers for you. They may not. And that's information on both sides of that fence as well. So I think there's a broad range of things to do it. I think that it's not something that it's, oh my gosh, it's, you know, impending doom. At the same point in time, it is a legitimate risk to your organization. And it needs to be given a reasonable amount of attention to address it.
Thank you to Mike for coming in, and you can hear more from him at the Akron CPE Day on September 18th or Dayton CPE Day on November 16th. Click on the links in the show notes to register for either of those. As always, remember to follow us on social media, and if you like what you're hearing, spread the word about the podcast. Send me your thoughts on this episode or an idea for a future podcast at jsalerno, J-S-A-L-E-R-N-O, at ohiocpa.com. Thanks for listening.